In the past, staple grains for all of Iran came from Sistan and Balochistan. But what for severe drought spells and misguided planning over the years, the province has completely lost that status. But today, in some areas of this province, and in the Bahu Kalat district in particular, all kinds of vegetables and tropical fruits are cultivated. There is a mango tree that's in full bloom, exploding with blossoms. In about 5 months, they will turn into delicious, juicy mangoes. This is heaven indeed. Walking around in the palm groves and other gardens in Bahu Kalat gives me a lot of peace. One of the most beautiful things I come across during my stroll is the Baluchi squirrel. The Baluchi squirrel, also known as the stripy or palm squirrel, is a unique species of rodents living in parts of Iran, Pakistan, India, Nepal, and Bangladesh. The most distinctive feature of this mammal is the dark stripes on a white background on its back. In the past, the inhabitants of Sistan and Balochistan believed these stripes were the fingerprints of the gods. A typical Baluchi squirrel is between 13 and 15 centimeters from its head to the end of its rump, and its tail adds an additional 14 to 19 centimeters to its total length. It's quite refreshing to see Baluchi children playing and gallivanting around in the banana groves. Beautiful, pure souls, the product of their serene, peaceful surroundings. Children of Shir Gwaz spend the whole week waiting to go to the fruit groves near the village to expend some of their inexhaustible energy. What they also do is they cook their traditional food on their own, and just like their elders, they gather around, sing, and play. The kids here have distinctive, innocent faces. They are just gorgeous. And they're all wearing their traditional costumes, boys and girls alike. All wearing traditional clothes. They are among the oldest, most original tribes in Iran. They're very noble and very patient. They are a people with a lot of patience. And although some of them don't have good living conditions, they are very patient folks. They're so content. The Baluchi culture is the perfect example of a culture of nobility and peace. And those cultural traits are readily visible in the architecture of the old houses in this village. The architectural design is endemic to Balochistan. You can't see anything like this anywhere else in Iran. There are also new houses in these areas with designs influenced by Indian and Pakistani cultures and architectures. One of the characteristics of Baluch families is their large populations. Wherever in the village I go, I'm surrounded by many of the little angels offering a breath of fresh air after a long day of hard work. They fill my heart with peace and joy. Perhaps one of the reasons these kids are so happy is their beautiful, tranquil, natural environments. Just as influential is the beautiful, happy colors used in the clothes that these little girls have on. clothes that are embroidered by the artistic hands of their mothers. Hand embroidery on colorful clothes and fabric is among the most important crafts of Baluchi women. And fortunately, Baluchi women have been able to preserve this exquisite art, a skill handed down through generations. It's noontime. It can get really hot in Shirguaz, even in the middle of winter. But the boys of the village have a good solution to fighting the scorching heat. What they do at a time like this is jump into the waters of Shirguaz River and swim to their heart's content. These children usually play together in groups. The day offers an opportunity for me to make a return to the beautiful carefree days of my own childhood. Live life as an uninhibited, unabashed explorer of the unknown. Playing with these children serves as an outlet for the negative energy in me. Although the children in Shirguaz don't have much to entertain themselves with, they are all growing up happy, healthy, and strong by playing in groups and making the best of what their natural environment provides them with. No computers to spend the whole day on, playing virtual computer games that don't involve any physical activity, video games that have taken the place of playing outside for many kids today, outdoor experiences in nature, and plenty of physical activity that a growing body craves. These children's only toy is nature, going up trees, diving into the river and swimming, playing with animals, singing songs and helping their parents at home and on the farm, frolicking around and playing with stones and pebbles. This non-stop joyful mobility is the reason behind these children's physical health and happy disposition. Very soon, I leave the village and set out for my next destination. I have to travel 250 kilometers to the west of Baluchistan, to a place 80 kilometers north of the city of Nikshar, a name that reminds me of my country's beautiful north. Given its unique geographical location, Baluchistan has a diverse and strange climate. Some parts of this area is affected by the tropical climate of India, in the south by the Sea of Oman, in the west by the Jazmurian inland basin, and in the north by Lut Desert. Surrounded by these different climatic conditions, Baluchistan features diverse lifestyles and various plant and animal species. Baluchistan is a dry, water-thirsty land. The average annual rainfall in the province is around 110 millimeters. But the important thing is, all that water comes down in only a couple of torrential rainfalls that cause the rivers in the province to overflow their banks. The ensuing flooding leaves behind a trail of destruction every time. The people here tell me they get snow and blizzards in some winters, too, because of the mountains in the Gorgan area. Perhaps you'll find it interesting to know there is a place named Gorgan in Sistan and Balochistan province. But no, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the city of Gorgan in the north of Iran. This area is comprised of around 11 villages punctuating this mountainous area. It can get freezing cold here. The people of Balochistan say, except for Mount Taftan and Mount Basman, the only other place where you can see snow in the highlands is the same Gorgan region in Balochistan. It can get really cold here. Because of the altitude and the relatively good rainfall here, this valley usually has a good amount of water. And abundant water means life and prosperity. The people of Gorgan are either farmers or orchard owners or livestock keepers. The most important thing for them to be able to do any of those things is to have clean drinking water. The people of the first village I visit are very kind and hospitable. In my conversations with them, I realize all the young people in the village are busy working simply because there is enough water. Everyone has something to do. They're all grateful to God for all their blessings. Their biggest asset is contentment. I could say most of the things I've seen in this village were built from scratch by the men and women living here. They are all content with what they have. They even have electricity. They live a beautiful, simple, and healthy life, away from the hustle and bustle of city life and excesses that distract human beings from their true self and from nature. The Baluch community leads a simple lifestyle in their simple homes in Balochistan. They don't even expect a paved road. The peace that these lovely people exude is a breath of fresh air against the vicissitudes of city life. I am so at peace when I'm in their fold. Before long, I resume my journey and arrive in the village of Archenik, a bucolic settlement second to none. But it isn't the architecture and natural environment that lends Archenik its beauty. The most beautiful thing I come across is the hospitality of the local inhabitants. Archenikis are hard-working, hospitable people. Moments after I reach the village, one of the elders comes to welcome me and invite me to his beautiful house. And the family gives me the red carpet treatment. Personally, I have a lot of respect for the culture and customs of this lovely ancient tribe and have tried my best not to have a negative impact on the culture or any of the good social norms of this community. Instead, I learned from them things that I had no idea about before I met them. I have had many trips to far and exotic places in Iran. And on those trips, I saw many and varied village houses and nomad tents. But nothing like the teeps in the Gorgan region. Beautiful, modest homes that offer peace and tranquility, just like their natural surroundings. Village elder, Pir Muhammad, fills me in on how they build their houses. My trip is nearing its end. That means I have to leave the beautiful Sistan and Balochistan province and head back home. I leave with a bag of experience and memories as sweet as the dates of Gorgan, and I do so knowing that I haven't done any harm to the natural environment and the culture of this ancient tribe.
I'm quite sure that this week's documentary about Iran's natural wonders intrigued all our audience across the globe, and I hope it inspires you to come and explore the hidden treasures of Iran. And that's it for this week. Do keep in touch with us, and until next week, goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The coronavirus pandemic cut U.S. life expectancy by a year and a half in 2020, down to 77.3 years, according to CDC data released recently. The huge drop was also driven by increased deaths from overdoses, murders, diabetes, and alcohol-related liver disease. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading USC's Steepest Single Year Decline in Life Expectancy Since the Second World War. Stay tuned for more. New Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data recently shows that life expectancy in the U.S. fell by 1.5 years in 2020, a decline fueled in large part by the deadly coronavirus pandemic. U.S. life expectancy at birth for 2020, based on nearly final data, was 77.3 years, the lowest it has been since 2003. Reads a new report from the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics. Mortality due to COVID-19 had by far the single greatest effect on the decline in life expectancy at birth between 2019 and 2020 overall. The new CDC figures indicate that 2020 saw the steepest single year decline in life expectancy in the U.S. from 78.8 years in 2019 to 77.3 last year since the Second World War. Give given that they are more likely to work jobs with a high risk of coronavirus exposure and lack adequate health care, Black and Hispanic people have been disproportionately affected by the pandemic and the resulting fall in life expectancy. Between 2019 and 2020, life expectancy decreased by 3 years for the Hispanic population, 81.8 to 78.8, the CDC found, adding, it decreased by 2.9 years for the non-Hispanic Black population and by 1.2 years for the non-Hispanic white population. Other factors contributing to the decline in life expectancy last year, according to the CDC, were drug overdoses, homicide, diabetes, and chronic liver disease and cirrhosis. It's horrific, and Case, a professor emeritus of economics and public affairs at Princeton University, told the Washington Post, adding, it's not entirely unexpected given that we have already seen about mortality rates as the year went on, but that still doesn't stop it from being just horrific, especially for non-Hispanic Blacks and for Hispanics. According to reports, nearly 3.6 million people died in the U.S. last year, around 375,000 of them from COVID-19, a disease that has now killed more than 600,000 nationwide and more than 4 million globally. COVID-19 was the third leading cause of death nationwide behind heart disease and cancer, causing 74% of the year's decline in life expectancy. Drug overdoses, which killed a record-breaking 93,000 people last year, were responsible for another 11% of the drop, according to the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics. Its report also shows that the gap in life expectancy between U.S. men and women grew by almost 12% in 2020 to 5.7 years. Men, whose life expectancy dropped to 74.5 years, have significantly higher odds than women of dying from COVID-19. The report also shows that how the pandemic ravaged the Latinx population in the U.S., which saw the largest drop in life expectancy, a three-year drop to 78.8 years, 90% of which was driven by COVID-19. Life expectancy among Black Americans dropped 2.9 years to 71.8 in 2020, the lowest life expectancy for this population since 2000, according to NCHS. In Case, Princeton economist, told BuzzFeed News in an email, there are reasons to hope that there will be some bounce back in life expectancy in 2021, but the extent to which that happens will depend on reaching communities that have been resistant to vaccines. Some evidence has shown that drug overdoses and alcohol-related liver disease or cirrhosis deaths are also linked to the pandemic, driven by increased stress and isolation. But Case noted that some of the increased deaths have to do with larger trends. Cirrhosis is a long-term disease, for example, and the dangerous opioid fentanyl has been becoming more widespread in the illicit drug supply. Some of the 2020 increase in mortality is probably part of the ongoing underlying crisis of so-called deaths of despair in the U.S., driven by wage and job losses among the working class, as well as exorbitant healthcare costs that have wrecked the country's health. Despite some predictions, the rate of suicides decreased by 4.6% last year, according to the CDC's figures. In a recent U.S. life expectancy study that came to similar conclusions, Virginia Commonwealth University researchers found that the pandemic worsened already bad health trends, such as increases in obesity, heart disease, and diabetes, driven by poor access to preventive health care in the U.S. as compared with other wealthy nations. The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Well, the end to any privacy is the way Pegasus, an Israeli spyware, could be described. The malware for mobile phones has been spying on anyone from regular citizens to heads of states and journalists. The audio and video of one's phone can be turned on without the owner knowing it. And everything can be accessed, from old messages to notes on your phone contacts. Nothing is safe. How dangerous is this, and what can be done to stop it? We will be taking a look at all of this on The Spotlight.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad Al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula O'Dean, and Anas Al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. Al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus, yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates.
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Author and researcher Daniel Gunja out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. Thank you both for being with us. Well, I'm going to start this off in Barcelona. And Daniel, we have heard for years that smartphones can listen in and even see its owners without them knowing. Tell me what is different about this Pegasus spyware and what makes it so much more dangerous.
Is able to be installed on the phone without the owner doing anything. It can be installed remotely without the owner having any idea that it actually is on their phone. It can access their messages, can access their camera, their microphone, and is basically able to have full control over all the content on their phone, which makes it very dangerous. Now, the issue with Pegasus had also been raised previously. This is it is not new that what we know about the software. What is new now is, of course, the extent of how many people individually in higher positions have been targeted, which, of course, creates a completely new reality of a very global surveillance that is being, the record has its source in the Zionist entity where it has been, where this software has been developed with the backing of the Zionist regime directly.
Well, let me go over to Ramiro. Daniel just said something about the Zionist entity, and I want to pick up on that as far as being an Israeli company and the danger of that in general, because we know that it is a regime that does not abide by any type of international law at all. Ramiro, your take on that side of it.
That's exactly right. I think the Pegasus software is extremely dangerous. It is part and parcel of the Zionist method of control using intelligence abroad. The founders of the quote-unquote State of Israel understood the importance of controlling key aspects of infrastructure and trade, controlling the key trade routes of society, hence why occupied Palestine or the State of Israel is where it is today, because it sits at the key intersections of infrastructure in the Middle East. Now, applying that same logic to the 21st century, what are the key infrastructure points? The internet, WhatsApp, Google, Facebook. These are the points of infrastructure that are used all over the world daily by every single person. I don't know a single person who doesn't have a smartphone, who doesn't have these apps. And so now we can consider these applications, these devices as key infrastructure. And yet, once again, the Zionists have taken control of this key infrastructure, control the information that flows in and out, and see and monitor anybody who's in any way speaking out against their client governments. In Latin America, for example, one of the more lesser reported stories is that the Israeli government has been selling Pegasus, the Zionists have been selling Pegasus to the governments of Mexico, Honduras, and Colombia, three of which are key drug trading countries that are involved in the drug trade in the United States. And this software has been used to monitor, track, and assassinate activists, journalists who have spoken out against the crimes of the Mexican government, the Honduran government, the Colombian government, in collaboration with Mossad, with the IDF, with Israeli intelligence. So this is something that affects the entire world, and it affects key infrastructure because everyone uses smartphone technology. And I think it's, again, part and parcel of the Zionist strategy of controlling the key points of infrastructure to make sure that nobody speaks out against their allies.
Daniel, your take on what Ramiro just said about as far as being selling this to certain governments. I want to look at the way that this malware can be used to control dissent, control whether we're talking about journalists, activists, and even sometimes heads of states. As we talked about earlier, that with this spyware, everything is accessible, which of course means very private information that could lead to blackmail.
It's dangerous in so many ways, especially because it is not only a tool that was developed by the Zionists, was developed by people who have ties to the Zionist regime and was approved by it. It was also promoted by the Zionist regime to be sold to different regimes, but also it is being sold, it is disseminated and used in different ways. And even in, if I remember correctly, in 2018, there was an article in the Zionist newspaper that there was an investigative report on how many countries and how many regimes have been using this particular software to spy, but not only to spy on journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, academics, but also to coerce and threaten and blackmail people or to persecute minorities. So this can effectively, of course, lead to an increase of state violence and can have drastic implications for individuals and for population groups, which is what makes it dangerous on so many levels. But of course, it is part and parcel of the Zionist strategy, because as much of other technologies and mechanisms that the Zionist regime is selling globally, it has consolidated itself globally as a force for the creation of methods of population containment and control that had been practiced and tested on Palestinians for at least the last 73 years. So much of the surveillance is tested in Palestine And in many ways, Pegasus is just one of the examples of the transnationalization of the violence against Palestinians, where Israel is using Palestinians and developing all sorts of methods that will help oppress people elsewhere and coerce people in key positions to coerce them into making decisions, which gives, again, the Zionist regime even much more power, potentially.
I mean, Romero, I mean, would you say that this cyber surveillance is a new weapon? Obviously, that is quite dangerous. And what needs to be done in order to control it, just as we have other weapons that there are various laws with it? What do you think about that? What can be done?
Cyber surveillance is definitely a weapon, not only because it serves to monitor your actions, to make sure that you stay in line, to make sure that you don't criticize Israel, to make sure that you don't criticize the U.S., the Western countries, but it also serves as a weapon, a mass weapon of distraction. Here in the United States, where I'm speaking to you now from, every day there are new applications, methods, devices, content designed to distract and miseducate the population, to keep people misinformed, to not care about what's going on around the world. And I think that this cyber surveillance, it plays a role as well when we're talking about predictive behavior and data. Based on the words that you type on your phone, based on the words that you say in conversations with people, the big tech companies, which are 100% in collaboration with the Zionist Entity of Israel, they use that data to predict your behavior and also to influence your behavior, to make it seem as if you want something that you really don't, to put content in your face and to want a desired outcome. And this is also used in the political sphere as well, where we see social media surveillance being used to promote regime change efforts in Cuba, to promote regime change efforts in the Middle East and all over the world. And so I think that cyber surveillance and spying and hacking is a huge threat, not only in terms of collecting data and keeping people in a low vibrational state of distraction, but also in terms of making you want something that you really didn't want. And I think in terms of correcting this, I think it really comes down to values. It really comes down to having progressive anti-imperialist governments realign the values of a society. I think Iran is doing a great job at that. I think countries like Nicaragua, Venezuela are doing a great job of that as well, where they're creating their own independent media companies, their own smartphone technology, their own devices that are free from some of the filth that we see in the Western societies, free from the hacking. And so I think it's really up to the anti-imperialist countries like Iran, like Russia, like China, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, to develop independent technologies and infrastructure so that they can't get to our technologies to begin with, to create things that aren't designed to distract us and keep us in a low state. Okay. And so I think that's it.
Well, what about that, Daniel? He just said about the, which I like, the weapons of mass distraction. And he talked about the anti-imperialist front. But as you know, the anti-imperialist front is continually under pressure, whether we're talking about economic sanctions or we're talking about in the media war, the soft war. And on the other hand, so when you're still using some of their platforms, as we saw with Press TV basically being shut down and taken off of .com, so where do we go with this? On the one hand, the pressure is on economically. On the other hand, if we use their platforms or use their smartphones, now we see the situation with actually the Israeli regime being in control of most of it.
Rather a dilemma. And I agree that there need to be new ways to be found in order for anti-imperialist factions to develop different kinds of, maybe through a collaboration of alternative media. I mean, Press TV has, this example you mentioned, when Press TV's domain was bought, Press TV managed very swiftly to use a different domain and still to continue its program without any major interruption, which showed that even those threats or direct forms of intimidation coming from the U.S. regime have been able to, Press TV was able to circumvent them. But of course, the danger is there, and effectively there would need to be different ways to find alternative platforms that can be used. But also, I agree with what the other guest said, it's of course also a question of values, because as long as there is this imperialist structure and as long as the Zionist entity exists, we will be faced with such challenges, because effectively even this cyber spying is just a digitalized form of different forms of spying that the Zionist entity has been employing for so many years, such as the conventional spying, where they would spy and conduct targeted assassinations against people. And these days, these things take place rather in online spaces. But there needs, of course, to be a continuous effort from within the resistance axis and from the resistance to counter these efforts, and of course, to remain aware of them.
Romero, why aren't we seeing more of a stronger reaction from Western governments? Because also some of them have been targeted. We saw that Emmanuel Macron of France, of course, was one of those that was targeted. And I mean, we have seen the reports coming out about Saudi Arabia and UAE, these authoritarian countries like this, using it to silence dissent. So these countries that at least try to say that they support human rights, some of these Western governments, why aren't we even hearing anything coming out of, for example, Washington or London in condemning this spyware?
I think Washington and London will never condemn any of the crimes of Israel and the Zionist entity, because it falls in line exactly with their foreign policy goals. When we're talking about the victims of these cyber attacks in the Middle East, we have, you know, targeting against Palestinians, against people in Yemen, against people in Afghanistan, Iran, and then in Latin America as well, you know, you have journalists, activists, academics in Mexico, Colombia, Honduras, countries that are neo-colonies of U.S. imperialism. All of that benefits the interests of Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange. And this is the new level and the new frontier of the war in the 21st century. We're no longer in the era of frontline soldiers and infantry combating each other. We're in a communicational war, a digital war of data, where if you have more data and information from your enemy, you can control them more. You can even predict their behavior. The technology with AI and algorithms is so advanced that you can manipulate a whole society into believing something that is not true. And so I think the reason why the Western countries will never call out Israel is because they're in fact collaborating with Israel to use this technology against their enemies, against their oppressors, and they're using this as a way to enter the next frontier of imperialism in the 21st century. And it's something that's very scary, and that's why I'm very proud of countries like Iran and Russia and China and others in the anti-imperialist bloc that are developing independent technology, because the second you agree to use their infrastructure, their technology, their apps, you're making yourself vulnerable to their exploitation, to them surveilling you if you speak out against them. And so it's so important for us to develop the next level of defense, a frontier, our own technologies, our own applications. And I think that's what it's going to take.
Daniel, what do you think about as for the possibility of a grassroots global movement in trying to get this type of spyware to be banned or to be deemed illegal? The possibility of that side of things?
As long as governments are continuing to use the spyware, I don't see much probability of that. Of course, now there is an awareness of the spyware, but still, like, even in the Western media, it hasn't been the Israeli role in it hasn't been as highlighted as much as it could have. And it has continued to be used by governments that, as you said, at least pretend that they are interested in human rights. While at the same time, of course, it also serves the Zionist regime to connect with its newfound allies. It has sold the software to the regimes in Saudi and Bahrain and UAE and so on, who don't even pretend that they care about human rights. So effectively, I do not think that that could lead to the software being banned. And even if the Zionist regime has been promoting itself as a technological hub, as a very advanced, digitalized entity. So I wouldn't be surprised if they have other software, so if they're already developing other things that they can use to continue spying on. And as long as they have Palestine as a testing ground, as a laboratory, where they are abusing Palestinians to develop all sorts of technologies, I do not see that there is a potential end to that coming from even from grassroots, as long as it's in the Western imperialist framework.
Well, what about that Ramiro, Daniel just talked about the Zionist regime and how it, even with this, even with the spyware, they're using it to try to promote themselves, like they are above the rest. Just from the, we know they use, from a military perspective, they use a lot of propaganda to say that they're the strongest and the most moral. And now in dealing with technology, it's as if they want to say, we are superior, we are above the rest, and sort of an intimidation factor. What can be done about this? And what do you think about resistance media and the role of basically educating people to what's going on? Your take on what needs to be done on that side of things.
I think that's such a great point. One of the talking points of the Zionists is that Israel is a free, is paradise. You can do whatever you want. They boast about engaging in behavior, decadent behavior, in behavior that's immoral and behavior that is against traditional values. And Israel posits itself as a land of high-tech freedom, of unlimited access to whatever you want. And even within the internet realm, we also see the same thing happening with a lot of the adult content that a lot of Israeli companies have been supporting in the United States and the Western Hemisphere, that they're strongly connected to that. And it's something that is really hard for us, in my generation especially as a millennial, to really understand, because when they compare themselves to more traditional countries, Islamic countries that are preserving morals and values, that are not engaging in this online behavior, they make it seem as if they're better. And that's part of the chauvinism and the arrogance of Israel. They say that they're free, they're advanced, they're in the future, but they make a false equation of being advanced and high tech with being decadent, with being lewd, with being all sorts of kind of things. And I think it's important for a new culture to emerge online that is not based on lewd adult content, that is not based on some of the arrogance, on the decadence that we see on social media and on media platforms in general that highlight gross wealth and fame and luxury cars. We have to create a new culture and a new technology based around families, based around traditional living, based around anti-imperialism, preserving our way of life aside from the empire. And okay. I think that this is the only way out.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this program. Author and researcher Daniel Jędrzejczyk out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles.